Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. This week my guest is Stefan Daniel of Leica Camera. Basically, he's the head of everything camera and photographic at Leica. He's been there for a long, long time, starting a career as a technician in 1984, and since then has occupied a number of roles through the company as he's climbed the ladder all the way to the top, and now has responsibility for their entire camera and sport optics lineup. I was really excited to get to sit down with Stefan for an hour or so and talk cameras and business and the way that they see their responsibility, I guess, within the marketplace. And we end on some fun stuff about his favourite lenses, one of which has been mentioned before on the show. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Stefan Daniel.
Two weeks of rain in Scotland this year.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Were you over for a launch or for holidays?
Holiday. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Holiday. Where at?
Yeah. We had a round trip. We took a ferry to Newcastle.
Oh, fantastic!
And then Edinburgh, Speyside.
Yeah.
Liverpool.
Nice. Speyside's where we are. You were probably about half an hour away from my house up here.
Oh, okay.
That's amazing. Yeah. We stayed in
Eberlaw.
Oh, okay, yeah. So we're Nethy Bridge, which sounds like a made up place. It sounds like Brigadoon, but it's near Aviemore. So it's very close.
Okay.
So yeah. So we've lived here just over a year now, and we used to visit a lot before we moved. And I do love that we see so many international number plates. Lots of German bikers and camper van type things, and then also loads of Dutch people come over as well. You see lots from the Netherlands as well. That's really good. So this part of the world does attract international folk, which is always
absolutely
always nice.
And it's beautiful, I have to say.
Yes,
really beautiful.
Yes, there was
even in the rain.
Well, it's funny, you just have to take, there's no such thing as bad weather, there's just being badly prepared, I think, is what I've landed on now. You just have to... Yesterday, I went for a walk, and I optimistically took my camera in my bag just in case. But unfortunately, it just poured down the entire time. But, you know, you're outside. You've got to... That's just what you've got to do. But, yeah. So it's a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. M, and talk about your time at Leica. I think when I was doing the prep and stuff, I can't quite believe how long you've been there. Like, you've been... It's a wonderful story. You may not love dwelling on the time. That's
then,
true.
Then we have something in common. I believe it neither. Yeah.
To start at that level and to go through like all of those, because you've touched a bunch of positions and a bunch of types of positions. And kind of one of the things that I thought it would be interesting to start with is you're obviously an enthusiast and you love photography and you loved image making long before you joined Leica. But how has that, reflecting on it now, the way that you've held each type of role, you've had technical roles, you've had kind of marketing and product type roles, now you kind of have to worry about the whole thing. Do you feel like that progression, how has that set you up, I guess, as you've moved through to where you are now?
It's, sometimes it feels right, sometimes it feels a bit heavy, but... all in all, I think with the experience and with the great teams we have, with the people, many people have a passion for photography, a passion for Leica as a brand, and also a passion for what they do on a daily work. And that makes it quite easy, I would say. It's not always easy. It's sometimes really, really hard to find the right path. But all this, what I just said, helps a lot. If you would have inexperienced people or people just doing a 9-to-5 job, it would be much, much more difficult.
Yeah, I don't think you accidentally land a brand or seek out working at Leica. Like, I don't think I was at in Wetzlar last year and did the tour and had the tour, the museum and the factory and everything. It was fantastic, and everyone I met was just really enthusiastic and patient with, you know, me visiting my version of Disneyland, right? Like, and seeing the place up close, you know, that passion definitely comes through.
It's also quite a common experience that that people who join Leica to say, it will add a nice line to my CV.
Right.
And like a year after a year, they are completely in flames and don't want to leave anymore.
No.
Or other people who are leaving Leica because they think maybe the grass is greener somewhere else. And after a couple of years, they come back. So there's definitely something special.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too. I think your community that you managed to kind of foster is very special. It's funny, the timing is interesting. Just popped up on Instagram before I sort of signed on to talk to you, was the on Instagram the post about the world deserves witnesses. And mm-hmm. I think that, do you think that's a long-term view, right? Like that kind of slogan, that isn't kind of like a quick, snappy sort of tagline like sell some cameras or whatever. That's a perspective, that's very opinionated. Is that a long-term view and thinking sort of longer term into the future? Is that part of what you feel is your responsibility?
I think that was Leica was always, that was what was Leica was about and is about, witness the world. And and I'm very happy that this time we didn't ask professional photographers to send us their pictures, but our customers.
Yeah,
and I think there is no difference in quality. The pictures, the first series now is, I love them all. It's fantastic.
There's amazing images. I do spend a lot of time on things like Instagram and Flickr, and just thinking I could put my camera down. You know, like it's the LFI is just an unreasonable place to go and look at images if you're starting out, but. It's just unreasonably good. Access and time is what you need, isn't it? You know, but yeah, it's very cool. So when you're running the company now, that long-term view, and you're thinking about like where products land and how you line these things up, how is the team structured into you? Can you talk a bit about like how you've structured those teams around you and how you kind of get involved? Are you deeply involved in lots of projects, or do you like to stand back and let the teams, you know, with customer insight and things like that, like drive projects and drive things through?
I think so if you look at the product management, which is somehow the core of customer-driven innovation, we have several work streams which run in parallel. First is that we have to respect a certain life cycle of a product, 3, 4, 5 years maximum. In a digital era, for a camera, a lifespan of more than 5 years becomes somehow difficult. This is where rule number one, there should be a successor if we decide to continue a certain product line minimum 3, maximum 5 years. This is one rule. The other is that we have to blend technological trends which are around us with our technical capabilities. Yeah, if we are not having a certain technology, we need to develop it or buy it somewhere so that we can offer a state-of-the-art product. And the third thing is that we really have to blend it into the Leica way of doing things, which is somehow or sometimes different from what you find elsewhere. And when we have all this mixed together, we need to involve our customers very early so that we check with qualitative customer research that it will... There is a likelihood that somebody wants to buy it when it comes on the market. So that we not just rely entirely on our gut feeling. I wouldn't say the gut feeling is not important, but we need to have like a double check with real customers.
Yeah, I feel like your timing is often very good as well, in terms of you seem to have anticipated some of the kind of popularity of point and shoots and things like that with things like the Deluxe 8, which a lot of people wouldn't have thought was in your kind of direct wheelhouse. Same with the Sofort 2. Like, I have both Soforts on the shelf behind me. I love those cameras. And I love that you have, again, you're open to different things. Like, the instant film is so playful. And so presumably you're not painting yourselves into a corner. You're not like, we are only one type of camera. We are only an M. We are only an SL. You're quite open to looking at other things, I assume. Like, and now with the Lux app, like, has that been a long running portfolio sort of view that you had? You're like, we want to be in each of these sectors and bring people in those different ways.
Yeah, it's a work of at least, I would say, 15 years. Because at the beginning of the digital era, our first objective was to survive, to continue the company. And I would say M8 and M9, finally the M9 was the breakthrough. Yeah. It's now 15 years and 2 days that we launched this camera on September 9, 2009. And this was for me the time, the date of turnaround, when, or the day when everything has changed, because it laid down the base of commercial success, of a good turnover and results for the company, which in consequence did enable us to enlarge our portfolio. Without the M9, and the X1 and the S2, which also have been launched at that day, it would not have been possible to extend the portfolio and do different streams like Sofort, instant camera, or continue the compact cameras, or develop an SL system and an L mount and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I can see that it would have been a really big turning point for you.
Yeah. And of course it would, it's never good only to stand on one leg. So we have established the Leica Q successfully. It became a very important part of our growth alongside the M and SL as well. Yeah. And so we have at least three solid pillars right now in the full frame segment.
Yeah, the Q's amazing. This podcast, I've joked with people before, has been in danger of becoming a Leica and Polaroid podcast, because everyone you speak to, irrespective of what camera system they use, the theme that comes back again and again is, if they do have a Leica camera, it's like, this one's for me. You know, like, this is my, if I, you know, they shoot another brand for work, but they go, no, but these ones, it's usually an M or a Q, but very often the Q, within minutes of starting doing these conversations, it seems to have just this Play-Doh versatility and performance that in that kind of pack, there's nothing else quite like it, is there?
Yeah, I would say it's a market niche which fits very well to Leica, the core values of Leica, the DNA of Leica, and on the same time seems to please a lot of new customers who do not own other cameras from Leica. I would say at the first, at the beginning, a Q, I have to say, entry. How do you say, a good entry drug?
Yes.
Or it's a very dangerous virus to become addicted to other products.
Yes. I mean, listeners to the podcast will know I have a one camera rule. So my M is my one. The M11 is my one, right? But I do, the Q turns up a lot, and I'm very tempted. I was speaking to Tiffany Roubert, the French photographer, a couple of weeks ago. She was on the podcast. She goes out this weekend, in fact. And she's a film photographer. She shoots with an MP. She shoots 35mm all the time. But even she has recently succumbed to the Q2 and has one of those for travel. And just, I think the price of film, the versatility of that. I mean, that lens. Have you ever been tempted to kind of take that Summilux 1.7 and put it elsewhere, because it's the reason to get the camera for me in a lot of ways. Like that 28 mm-hmm. 1.7 is a spectacular piece of glass.
Yeah, it's because it's so spectacular because it's not an interchangeable lens. It's impossible to just put a bayonet on the rear, because the rear lens element is like, I think, 0.8 millimeters from the right. sensor surface. Mm. And it's matched yeah. to go full frame. We get pretty much a question, why can't we do a Q with interchangeable lenses? Yeah, because these lenses would be as big as the SL yeah. lenses. Yeah. yeah. And that's a trick. There's no focal plane shutter. Yeah. You can optimize this lens to that very special sensor. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's why it's so amazing. Yeah.
No, it's wonderful. This, doing the podcast is potentially very expensive because I always end up on the conversations and go, well, maybe. I've also attempted to get an M5 recently and go back and shoot some film. I have the lenses, so I may as well, you know, have the body. It's an investment. It's a
M5 is, I would say, it's not the most beautiful camera we've ever made, but it's a pleasure to use, yeah. I have to say.
I think it's a little underappreciated. I think it was an interesting, you know, it's an interesting look. I think the rest of the M line feels like a Porsche or something, like the 911. You know, it's kind of, it was perfect at inception and it sort of stayed. But I like the M5 because it has a kind of utilitarian, I think it was ahead of its time in its appearance, actually. I think it was a sort of 80s aesthetic in the 70s, in a way. It looked quite cool to me. I may be alone in that. it's a big chunky one. I know that, but yeah, I should really get one.
But it feels right in the hand. It's not bad. But the look was not appreciated. But it's like
yeah.
this.
I think you've definitely landed. There's an aesthetic now. For the M series and sort of they're all different, I think, which is the other exciting thing about them. They're all kind of independent. Could I ask, when you were talking, we talked about the Sofort briefly before, that first Sofort camera was what, 7 years ago now, and then the second one has just come out at the end of last year. It's a fantastic little camera. How does something very consumer, very fun, very light, how does that fit in terms of your ideas? Like when you first did it, there was the story went around that like it came up from a conversation around board members that was almost like, let's do something fun. And then you're partnering with someone to help sort of like with the film and things like that. How did that first fit? Did people think in the company think that was unusual? Because it's very not, it's not a core project. It could be seen as a bit of a trifle, you know?
Yeah, it was the story is that it was brought by our main shareholder, the idea, Dr. Andreas Kaufmann, and the chairman of the supervisory board. And when he approached us first with this idea, we said, okay, really? So we looked a bit deeper what's going on in this market and how many cameras are sold. And for and who is you did use at that time this kind of product, and we did find out quite quickly that there is a fit to the brand, and it's also making Leica a bit more or less serious, more approachable. I don't know if this is a term, but accessible.
Yeah, I have said it's the most affordable camera in the lineup, and actually, in some ways, the most versatile because it prints the images and it becomes a small printer when you're carrying it as well. It's very cool.
Yeah, yeah, and people. I had just the same experience last Saturday. I was invited for a wedding. And I brought some of the cameras and, oh, really, you can do that? And can you print this for me? And people are really see a value in this product. Yeah, of course, it's not our main focus. Yeah, but also it plays an important role into our Leica retail organization and Leica stores, because to sell an M with five lenses at the same time. Doesn't happen every day, but these little cameras are being sold on a frequent basis. So it plays a role for us as well.
Yeah, I've always had great experiences in your stores. That feels like an important touch point for you as a manufacturer and as a maker of things. The team always seem to really understand whether I'm in Seattle or London or New York. The New York space is incredible. That new space in the meatpacking district. That presumably is a very important thing for you to kind of make sure that people are the right people to talk to customers and things like that. You know, do you get quite closely involved in that? Because that seems like it's a push now to like keep building these spaces.
Yeah, it's you know, we started this more than almost 18 years ago. The first lacquer store was opened in Tokyo. And since then, it's really has become a part of the brand exposure. And also, it has become a very important sales channel, a really important sales channel. So Leica is still available at the regular photo dealers. But as you know, they became less and less. And sometimes also the quality in how to show the camera and the experience of buying is maybe inferior to a Leica store sometimes. So it was only logical to build up our own retail channel.
Yeah, well, you say that, but I think that's one of the things that marks you out as a really interesting manufacturer is that I think it is logical. I think it does make sense. I think if you want, you should make a direct connection with your customer, you know, and go and visit them and, you know, or be in a place where they are and, you know, create an experience around something that creates connection. But I don't see other brands doing that. And so I think that's what I appreciate about you as a company is that you are very much steering your own course. And that seems to be like you will take your time with decisions and do the thing that you think is right.
That's, maybe that separates us. Also, maybe other Japanese brands see themselves in the consumer electronics market. We don't.
Yeah, buy a camera from someone who makes cameras, not also printers. It seems, It's a decision I took.
Don't get me wrong. They have beautiful products.
Of course.
Super performance. It's not about, but it's how you perceive yourself. They're like our premier objective is photography.
Yeah. No, I think that's very clear. On the subject of photography, like, are you optimistic about the future of photography? We've gone through 18 months of massive change in terms of, I'll put air quotes around it, but image making is changing, and the tools around image making are changing. The content identification features that you're building into cameras now, the fact that you're still very heavily invested in a very manual camera system that people, you know, people choose for its manualness and choose for its, you know, it's still very, very high performance and very modern, but it's through the lens of something more traditional. Are you optimistic about the future of kind of traditional photography and the way that those tools will sell? Because we've gone through a blip. And I think the dust is starting to settle now. Where do you see it going, and are you optimistic?
I think you have to see it in a much more long term. Before the little point and shoot cameras came along, the photography market worldwide was about 40 to 50 million, maybe 35 million cameras per year. Then with the digital point and shoot, it went up to 140 million. That was back in 2010. And then it started to shrink again, but only to the level where it was before digital. So I think for the camera industry, there's no reason to complain because average price of a digital camera is much higher than the analog camera has ever been. So I only can say that it's a question of perspective how you look onto it. And for me, it's not in a crisis. As you said, the dust has settled, and the sales figures are very stable. Yeah, even growing in some segments like instant cameras, like full-frame mirrorless cameras. These are all very vital business segments. So I look optimistic in the future, and we don't see smartphones as an enemy to cameras, because today much more people are in contact with photography than it has ever been since photography was invented. And if only the smallest portion of these billions of people get interested into or want to do more with photography, with a higher quality, with a more versatile shooting experience, or they want to be more ambitious, they will end up with a camera. And that's what's happening now. Yeah, people step up from a smartphone to a Deluxe 8 or Q3, whatever. So I'm not worried about that.
No, I spoke to Victor last week from Fjordn actually, and what they make and the way that they make the grip that pairs so perfectly. And I will say, I love the Lux app as well. That's fantastic. I was quite skeptical of a camera app, but actually I've now mapped it to the action button on my phone, so I can just launch that rather than the default camera. I use that more because I love the color and I love the black and white simulations especially are tremendous. Like that is another example for me of I didn't wake up that morning expecting Leica to produce a camera app for phones. But I'm very glad it's there, and I'm glad to hear that you think it's a complement to the whole. From your perspective, is that how it has to fit in? Like you're a bit like the gateway drug with the queue, introducing
It's
people.
also if you're not yet ready to buy a camera, but you use the Leica Lux app, and then maybe you remember Leica as a brand name and say, oh, these pictures look nice. If some people want to do more one day, they might consider Leica.
When you're that speaks, I guess, to values as well, and baking something in and attracting people to a brand and buying them into a way of doing things rather than just I'm just taking photos and I don't really care what I use to take those photos. Does that value, how does that bake into the products as well? How do you instill that down? Like if I'm a new employee and I'm joining one of the product teams, how is that sense conveyed? I mean, obviously they must know something about Leica before they've joined, but how do you make sure that they're aligned with you in that, in values and in the way that you think about those sorts of things?
So it's not really necessary for everybody. So if you are, let's say you are assembling lenses down here in the ground floor, you don't need to be a photographer necessarily. Yeah, but if you are a product manager, a marketing specialist, as a project leader, then you should have a clue what is the aim of the customer. Yeah, what should the final product stand for? And that comes, I would say, it comes naturally. Also, it's word to mouth. We have free programs of loaner cameras, so everybody who is going on to holiday has a possibility to get equipment for the holiday. So we encourage people to use our products, and it's not a burden. Even people from HR are enthusiast photographers, and they have not been when they started with Leica.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it's very easy to do that, yeah. And I always say it's a unique combination of heritage on the one hand, which makes you proud to work for Leica, And then you have an object which is a beautiful one in itself. But what you can do with it is art, creativity, etc. And this combination is quite unique.
To sit, my day job is in video games. I'm unburdened by this being my day job. Like, as when I talk to photographers, it's because of my passion for image making and photography, but I can come to it as an enthusiast and I don't have to, I'm not burdened with it. And we do the same thing. We encourage people to play games and explore it widely. If you sit at the intersection of art and creativity, it's quite a great place to work, isn't it, really?
So, and I think there are always different members and teams. There are ones who are really standing for what the customer thinks, and they bring that also to the others. And if you are like an imaging sensor specialist, it's not really, it's not mandatory to take photographs all the time.
Yeah, no, exactly. So now that you sit atop all things photographic and sports optics and things like that, how do you balance your own enthusiasm and passion? Like, because I imagine I would be the worst person to be in charge of a camera company, given how excited I am by bells and whistles and widgets and things like that. How do you balance the your own interest and excitement around something? You know, have you had to learn to kind of stand back a little bit and sort of sit on your hands? Because when you're a product owner, you go out every day and really fight for your product internally in the organization. Now, presumably, you have to balance everyone else doing that, you know, towards you.
It's I don't yeah, it's a difficult question. I'm not only a product enthusiast. I learned to be a businessman too. It will automatically hinder you doing the most crazy things, which maybe we only find two customers in the world or something. Because you always have to check whether there is a market, is the economic value given, does the company earn money on it or not? And that will sometimes I'd wish that there would be less limits, but it's like
Yeah,
this.
no, it's the way it is. When you traveled then, when you were in Scotland, what did you bring with you? Just out of curiosity, was it the Q for ease and travel going, or did you bring an M or?
I hope my wife doesn't listen to this podcast, because I traveled with my wife and she's not so into photography. And this also is because I could stand for 3 hours waiting for the right light to happen. And if you have a traveling companion who is not into photography that much, it's a bit difficult. That's why I brought a Q3 for her and a Q3 for me.
No, that makes all the sense in the world. I have that challenge. We did a vacation episode this year of the podcast where people phoned in effectively with their sent voice notes with their holiday travel gear. And my wife recorded one at the end saying that her travel photography gear was bringing me. But at the same time, you have to keep an eye on it because otherwise it stops and takes photos of trees for ages and wanders off. And she's like, there's a lot of management, but she does get to travel with her own photographer, and that's quite helpful. So it's quite
Okay,
good.
yeah.
She accepts it now, for better or worse, that it comes with me. But that's very cool. Were you at Lights Park last week for the celebrations? Was it last weekend that there was the kind of open celebrations?
No, unfortunately not. I was on that wedding, playing around
Of
with the
course.
sofas.
Ah, well, you know, cake and so forth. There's worse places to be.
But from all what I have heard, it has been a tremendous success. Great weather, lots of people. So definitely it's going to be
Yeah,
continued.
good. I had some friends who visited. It seemed like it would be a great time. You've got an amazing kind of setup there, actually, with the cafe and the hotel and everything. Was it always the plan? I guess from a business perspective, it's very helpful to just have everything on site. You know, you can control, you can hold events there, you can host people. was it always both commercial and business, or was it that you needed this for yourselves and then saw the opportunity to commercialize it more broadly?
Yeah, I think that was the objective from the very first thought, that this should be not only a production facility, then it wouldn't have to be built like it was built. It could be much more practical, or much more, you could build it for less money than and have the same quality. So it was built from the very beginning as a meeting point, as a destination for people who love photography. Mm-hmm. And I think that concept really worked out very well.
Yeah.
And it also helps, by the way, to make Leica attractive as an employer mm-hmm. in the area, because everybody knows, that's where the big globe is. So it's a good place to work as well.
When I visited, I got off the train in Wetzlar and walked up to the taxi rank, and the guy at the taxi rank, it was a Saturday morning, he took one look at me and just went, "Lights Park?" And I went, "Yes." I obviously had a look with like thick rimmed glasses and grey hair. I was just, I obviously stood out.
and the camera.
Oh yeah. My M was like strapped across me for sure. So it was good. I had a terrible journey down though. The trains were all messed up coming from Cologne, and so I arrived for my 12 o'clock tour at the museum at 11:59. So I was running very, very late, and everyone was lovely, and I arrived as a big sweaty mess, and they were like, "Take a moment, go whatever, have a cup of coffee, have a cake." The coffee and walnut cake was tremendous, by the way. It's very, very good. So I mean, obviously, I'm not expecting scoops. I don't think you will go into details and stuff. But how are you feeling about the roadmap for things that are coming next? Like the 11 and the 11P are out. You've got the Q3, which seems to be doing really well. I see Greg Williams running around with that, taking amazing photographs all the time. Talk to me about like where you want to go, if you can, about where you think you might go. Like the Sofort's out there for the fun side. Like, how are you thinking about the next thing, like what keeps Leica moving forward? Because it's very easy to say there'll be an SL4 or a Q4 or something, you know, that sort of makes sense. But like, how do you think about anticipating the future needs and kind of where you go?
It's a difficult question in two ways. I cannot talk about M12 right now. And on the other hand, it's difficult because the products we have right now are quite performing, quite mature in what they do, and it becomes much more difficult to integrate a sensible feature to screw up or to crank up quality more and more and more, so that I would say we will continue to evolve in terms of an evolution, and people should not expect a revolution with all cameras. And we are also, as I said, we'll have three solid pillars now: SL, Q, and M, and the compacts and so on. It's a lot. It's a lot of products for a relatively small company like ours, and there is no plan to extend it by another something.
I think that makes all the sense in the world. I think also you touched on it there a little bit. I don't know what we'll do with the inevitable 100, 150, 200 megapixel sensors that are coming in our lifetime. Like it feels like the capability of the hardware already exceeds kind of what we need as photographers most of the time. Is that how you think of it, or do you have a different perspective?
You know, if we would have followed or really done what was said 10 years ago, that 24 megapixels is totally insane and too much, and 15 would be the optimum, look where we are now. We have 60 megapixels in full frame, and it's great, especially on a Q3. Yeah, you have like a light telephoto lens built in. It's great. So I wouldn't say 100 megapixel is too much or whatever. Yeah, we might find applications for it which do make sense. Maybe not.
Yeah, I think if anyone's going to find applications for it, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you have rooms full of people who are thinking about this stuff already. Yeah. But yeah, I shoot my M mostly on 36 because, again, I'm trying not to create a huge library of images. And I think upscaling images, in my lifetime, it's already fairly good. You know, I can take a 1.7 megapixel photo and make it better, you know, and tweak it and improve it. So I think that yeah. side of things is also going to catch to a point where my aging eyes won't be able to see the difference if it was upscaled or processed in some sort of way, you know?
You know, it's... So, of course, technology is important, mm-hmm. but technology is not everything.
Yeah.
It's, of course, you need a good tool, mm-hmm. but to make a good picture, it needs much more than a good tool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly this word. A photographer was asked by a cook, "Oh, you have so beautiful photographs. You must have a good camera." And the photographer responded, "Oh, you must have great cooking pots because your food is so delicious." It's
yeah. No, you're right. And actually, that was something I wanted to ask about as well, because you have such a great stable of photographers who make incredible images all the time, who are very outspoken about using your cameras and using your gear. I've spoken to Doug Menway on the podcast, for example, and, you know, like you've got even the celebrity stuff. Like, this podcast exists because of a dream I had that Jason Momoa was showing me his lens collection. And I was like, that should be a thing. That'd be quite fun. And so, you know, I've joked that when I speak to Jason, the podcast will end. Like, that will be the final interview. But I guess that must be very exciting for you all to see. Like you said about your customers' images being so impressive, and then you've got professional photographers working as well. Just the tide of imagery coming in must be quite a real boost to the team to see it. Like, do you display it a lot? I know you've got the exhibitions and things that happen on the premises, but there must just be this constant flood of images coming in. Like, can you do anything with that? Do you do anything with that to show people, you know?
Of course, we our Leica Academy team here in Germany started exhibitions with the customers' images.
Yeah.
And there are two things. It's a great exposure for Leica, mm-hmm. but also it's a great exposure for the people who attended these trainings yeah. and have a great result. Makes them proud, so it's a win-win situation for both, yeah. and so we try to involve our customers more and more over time, because in the end it's for them we make these products.
Yeah, I think it feels more authentic as well, with a bit more heart as well, if it's coming from people. It's not just someone, you know, like, speaking to you is great because but you work for the company. Whereas hearing someone else's perspective who's like, I use this thing and I think this tool is incredible, I think also carries a bit more weight when, you know, when you're thinking about talking to other creatives. Like, other creatives don't contact a camera company to ask them which camera they should buy. They go on Reddit or they go on Instagram and they see what other people are using and they get feedback from them. So I think that's probably mm-hmm. the right way around to think of it. You have a very international family as well. Like, it seems that by design, your first flagship was opened in Japan. You've got all these stores around the world. You're very international with your photographers. Is that how you think of what photography can do as well, from a, like, an impact globally and, like, bringing people, making the world feel smaller and bringing perspectives?
Photography is a universal language. Mm. You know, it's, yeah, maybe it's our little contribution that people understand each other better. And the funny thing is, when you're crossing or you run into another photographer, I think with two people owning a Japanese camera, maybe something happens, but maybe most likely not. And if two Leica photographers cross, at least it's a nice gesture, but I think most of the cases it's a nice talk. What lens do you have on, and what other cameras do you have? And so it's you be part of a family, and that's a nice thing about Leica as well.
No, definitely. I've definitely encountered that around the world. I bumped into there was a guy at an airport I was traveling recently, and he had his M6 around his neck whilst he was pushing his baby to sleep, his little girl. He was from France and he was visiting family in Scotland, and it was Inverness Airport. And I never expected to run into another Leica guy, but we both clocked each other's cameras and had a little chat. It was really nice. It's lovely. And you're right, I haven't had that with other brands, with other manufacturers. I think that community is very important. Like it's very unusual to find that kind of, but it seems healthy. It seems good, you know, like you're investing in it in the right way and putting a bit of energy into it.
But it you know, we haven't been promoting this in a way we couldn't. But it just happens like this.
No, it's lovely. It's a lovely group to be a part of. I had Danny Bly, who was the first interview on the podcast, a friend of mine, when I first bought my first M, which was an M10. And he sort of hit me up when I messaged him. I was like, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna hit the button. And I'd never used one before, but I had held one and was like, yeah, I think this is it. And I knew I was a goner the moment I heard the shutter go, and I was like, yep, that's me now. I've found the tool and I want to master this and sort of find a bit of creativity. But that support network doesn't exist for when you just, you know, when you buy a washing machine. Like it exists when you buy this very
I would
personal
say
tool.
very rarely.
Yes. Maybe some folks at Miele, I don't know. Like there's very few kind of storied companies like that, you know, that have that kind of fit, I think. When you think about like where you are now and how the company has changed, and you hinted at it with the M9 actually, and you were saying like this was a turning point, this kind of was a necessary, quite difficult shift for the company. I think you've been there through a lot of harder times, better times. It feels like these are better times than some other times. How do you reflect on like how it feels now to have got to where you are? Because you've seen it all. It's very unusual to speak to someone who has that perspective across very challenging times like that. Like, what do you think the legacy is of a company like Leica in 2024 and beyond? Like, what do you hope that you pass on to the next, you know, to the people coming up now who 40 years from now maybe might be interviewed in this little way?
It's, you know, we are all quite proud of what we have achieved over the last, well, let's say 1.5 decade. But at the same time, having been through these difficult times makes you always cautious and not just relax, sit back and relax, and say, ah, we made it and now it will run forever. If you stand still, you go back. And this is very important always to say, okay, what's next? How can we appeal to our customers? How can we find new customers? What are the new technologies? We always have to look forward. It's because it's a big risk that you say, ah, now it's running and I'm done. It's the beginning of the end.
I've launched a camera. I'll see you in 5 years' time when we do the next one. No, absolutely. I do love the way that you guys play with the formula as well. Like you take the existing thing and tweak it and adjust over time. You don't just, you know, the M11 that came out during the pandemic is a different M11 to an M11P to, you know, the special editions and things.
It's also, you know, we have to deal with the not so pleasant things, like we had issues on the M11 series with freezing, and so we have worked very hard to solve it, and it was not just a single reason, but multiple reasons for these freezings. And fortunately, I can now report that we have done it, and all the testers and all the users say, ah, now it's really rock solid, and we are, we've done it. So it means, in other words, that just launching a product and then forget about it is not possible in our case.
No, I think in a world where everything is a tiny computer, it's very difficult as well. Like, there's so much. It's both simpler and more complex than it has ever been. Do you think some of those challenges came about because of the pandemic? You know, finishing a project at home, effectively, or finishing a project under those conditions. I don't think anyone in our generation has done that. Do you think that contributed to it?
Might be. Might be. This is a logical reason. Yeah. Also, it was developed under harsh conditions.
Working in games, we had the same challenges. Suddenly, everyone was at home, finishing projects that were designed and, you know, started together, and that was such a difficult thing to do. And we at least were shipping software, not hardware, so you can adjust that as you go. But there was a real knock-on effect, actually. The stuff that launched in 2020 was broadly okay because it was nearly finished. It was everything afterwards that just sort of got hit and slowed down in ways that we couldn't really anticipate while we all kind of worked out what was next, I guess. But yeah. Well, Stefan, thank you so much for giving me some time. Very, very appreciative of getting the chance to sit down with you because you're a busy guy. Is there anything you want to point people at before you kind of sign off or suggest that people go and have a look at? Or, you know, you can announce a product if you like. I don't mind.
Stay tuned for tomorrow.
Okay.
3 o'clock German time. September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
This is a pre-announcement. And yeah, I think you asked me questions about my three favorite lenses. Yeah.
Oh yes, well, I wasn't gonna. So I hadn't. I hadn't heard back. And, I wasn't sure if you had three. I don't.
Yeah,
so I don't like to put pressure on people. Oh no, let's do it. Let's do it.
No. Yeah.
It'd be very cool.
Number one, 35 Samilux M.
Yep.
For me, it's the most universal lens we have in our lineup. Yeah.
Yep.
I can do everything with that lens.
Yes.
For me, 35 and 1.4 is just great.
I'm a 35
it's not
guy.
Too big. Yeah. It's not too big. It's not too heavy. Nice bokeh. It's, Oh, number one.
Yeah, cool.
Number two, maybe it's a surprise to you, is the Apo Macro Elmarit 100 millimeter. 2.8 R.
That is a surprise. Yes, the R. Okay.
Yeah, I think that was for the time when it came out, 1986, I think, was out of this world in terms of the image quality.
Mm.
And I remember that Kodak used especially this lens to promote their Ektar 25 color negative film. And there were huge prints done on an R camera with 100 millimeter macro. And I have one and I use it sometimes on the M camera or on the SL.
Yep.
And it's still a great performer.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah. And number three is the Simulux 50 non-aspherical.
Right.
The lens, which was built from 1961 till 2004. So that speaks for its quality.
Yeah.
And I love the rendering of this lens.
Yes.
It's a bit creamy and soft, wide open, but it becomes quite okay.
Yeah.
If you stop it down. So I love it, I have to say, as well.
Well, that's the pleasure of an interchangeable lens system, though, isn't it? Is that you can, depending on your mood, you know, you can switch around. I have one of the old Tele Elmerit 135 f4 lenses, which I love for the way that it makes things look. It's great for portraits. It's great for that. But it has a real. It's sharp, but it's not clinically sharp. And I think that it has a slightly filmic sort of feel to it. And it's funny that you mentioned the 100mm, because previous guest of the show, Justin Mott, who lives in Hanoi in Vietnam, he has that lens adapted to his M, and he uses that a lot for portraits, and when he's doing workshops lets people use it. And it's astonishing. And I think someone in one of your stores kind of encouraged him to try it adapted, and he walked away with it straight away. He was like, this is a fantastic lens. So I'm really glad that you picked that one. It's a good choice.
And imagine this is a 40-year-old design.
Yeah.
It's still like, fantastic.
Yeah. But I do wonder sometimes whether that creates challenges for you as an organization, because some of the lenses are so optically amazing that I'm sort of like, I have, like, for example, the Elmerit 28, I love, I think is a really underappreciated, my brethren in the Leica community don't talk about that lens enough. Like, I don't think they give it enough credit and enough love, because again, it's very, very small and it's really beautiful rendering of the images and things like that. But you've kind of, the formula is set for some of these lenses that kind of like potentially makes it quite hard, I guess, for you, you know?
The good thing is that the life cycle of a lens can be very long. Our current Summicron 50 in the M range dates from 1979.
Yeah.
And it's still a very good lens. Yeah. It's not as good as the upper Summicron, but it's a fairly decent lens. So to be able to sell it over such a long period speaks for itself.
Yeah, that's the 50
I have. And that people still want to buy it. That also speaks for itself.
Yeah, no, I have that. It's a wonderful lens. And I think it's a testament to that, that there are so many blog posts and things like that out there that talk about, well, this version is good for this, and this version I like for these reasons. Dan Baker was previously on the show. His three lenses were 335s, which I fully appreciated. Two Summiluxes and a Summicron, which he has. And he reassured me on the call that if another 35 came out tomorrow, he would also buy that one. he's just obsessed. He loves it. But he shoots an M6 and an M11, so I guess there's a justification there for having two at very least. Well, that's brilliant. Well, thank you for sharing those with me. I really appreciate it. Sorry, I didn't push on it because I wasn't
don't worry. I wasn't communicating this before, but
No, you've done your homework. That's excellent.
I've done my homework, yes.
That's very good. Brilliant. Well, Stefan, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this. It's a pleasure. I hope one day to be back at Lights Park and maybe we can do this in person or something like that.
Yeah, and or we have a coffee together.
Yeah, fantastic.
Okay.
All right. Super. Have a great rest of the day. Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye. Take care.
Thanks again to Stefan for taking some time to chat there and for being great about us nearly missing his lenses. I think a lesson for me going into these conversations is everyone's just a person, and I was a bit too excited going into this one, and I think as a result I may have been too cautious and got to lenses too late. So a lesson for next time, but you know, we'll have that coffee and maybe I'll get to talk to him when there's an M12, who knows. If you enjoyed that conversation, don't forget that you can rate and review the series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and that really helps other people to find the show. You can also sign up to the weekly newsletter, and that's on ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there's a link to that and our new Patreon in the show notes if you want to help support me in hosting the show from a technical standpoint. So if you want to help me pay for web hosting and newsletters and all that other good stuff. Speaking of newsletters and running the thing, I'd better go and finish that newsletter for this coming week. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next time.